I'm there. If you don't want to be with Mommy, well, I won't let anyone mess with you. I'll carry you out of the tunnels myself.
Rex had never had a real friend before. Not one like Sly, anyway. Sly would do anything for him. They heard the garage door open.
Tell Pierre to bring them down, Rex said. Let's get ready to meet Chief Sao.
Chapter 30. A New Need. Aggie James stared at the bassinet. No, he couldn't do it. He couldn't allow himself to succumb. Just ride it out. You'll be free soon. He looked away. Not that there were many places to look. The tiny room must have once been part of the sewer system, back in the times when they built things out of rough-hewn rocks. At least it was warm. The room had power. Hillary had turned on a beat-up heater and an old dehumidifier as soon as they'd arrived. He wore the same clothes he'd had on when Sly and Pierre had taken him to the White Dungeon. The clothes had been waiting for him here. Hillary had cleaned the jeans, shirt, and jacket. She'd given him a pair of tan work boots that were almost new, if you didn't count the blood stains set into the suede. For the first time Aggie could remember, he was clean, both inside and out. Yet now he felt a powerful urge, an urge that made him feel dirty. How could he want that? How the hell could he want that? Aggie turned. He stared at the baby. So tiny, so helpless. But what would it become? Would it change to look like those things that had chased down the teenage boy? The baby hadn't hurt anyone. The baby just was. Aggie walked to the bassinet and looked down. The baby slept so peacefully, so quiet, all bundled up in that blanket with the strange symbols. Aggie thought of the day his daughter had been born, thought of her tiny fingers, and the way her eyes had closed when she'd slept against his wife's chest. But this boy wasn't like Aggie's lost child. This boy was Hillary's kind, the killing kind. This was a creature of evil. So why did Aggie want to pick the baby up? Why did he want to hold it? The urge consumed him. It was even more powerful than that inexplicable lust that had overtaken him while watching Mommy in her cabin. It was more than a want. It was a need. He needed to pick up that baby, needed to protect it. He could fight it no longer. He reached into the bassinet and gently lifted up the tiny sleeping form. Aggie held the baby to his chest, one hand under the baby's tiny bottom, the other hand on the back of the baby's head. Aggie started to bounce slightly. "Don't you worry," he said. "It'll be okay. It'll be fine." It was just a baby, goddammit. This child was no more responsible for what his kin had done than Aggie was responsible for the actions of his asshole grandfather. The boy didn't have to turn out like Hillary. He didn't have to turn out like those kids in the maze. The small room's metal door screeched as it opened, the bottom scraping heavily against the cinder block floor. Aggie instinctively turned the baby away from the door, protecting it with his body. He looked over his shoulder to see who had come. Hillary. She entered and smiled.
"How nice. You are holding the baby."
Aggie nodded. She reached out her wrinkled hand and smoothed the baby's blanket. Aggie fought an instinct to pull the baby away from her. He had to keep his cool. She again looked at Aggie. Her happy eyes returned to their normal hard-eyed stare.
"Are you ready to learn what you must do?"
Aggie nodded again.
"You are to find this baby a good home," she said. "You take him out of here. Find him a good home, a loving home, a safe home."
She stared at him, as if waiting for an answer, waiting for confirmation. He had no idea what he should say.
"Repeat it," she said. "A safe, loving home."
"Yes, ma'am. A safe, loving home, but, well, how do I do that?"
Hillary pointed a finger at the ceiling.
You live up above. Find someone who wants a baby. Someone who will stay in San Francisco, do you understand? They have to stay here. You must find someone. Do you know people?
Aggie had zero idea of who would take in the little black baby, but he nodded.
Sure, of course. I know people just like that.
Good,
she said.
I knew I chose right when I chose you. When you find the people who will take him.
She reached into her sweater pocket and pulled out an overstuffed brown envelope.
You give them this.
Inside the envelope, Aggie saw a thick stack of hundreds.
You listen to me now,
Hillary said.
You listen carefully. I have people up there. No matter where you go, we can find you by your smell. You do what I say, and you are free. You do not do what I say. Then wherever you go, I will reach out from here and pull you back in. And then you will be the groom.
That giant slug of a woman, being tied to the dolly, then the maze, the monster children. Aggie nodded madly. If this was the price of freedom, he would fulfill her mission.
Yes, ma'am, I understand, but...
His voice trailed off. He wanted to ask a question. But what if the answer made her change her mind? No, with all the trouble she'd gone through, she wasn't going to suddenly take the baby away. He had to ask.
Why don't you take him? Aggie said. I mean, I'll do what you ask, and thank you for letting me live, thank you. But why wouldn't you just take him up yourself?
She caressed the sleeping baby's cheek.
I can't go far from home. When I am away from Mommy for too long, I start to change.
Change into what?
She didn't say anything. For a long moment it was so quiet Aggie could hear her fingertips sliding across the baby's cheek. Finally, Hillary looked up.
You ask too many questions. Don't you want to help me?
Oh, shit, had he blown it? Aggie nodded, hard.
Yes. I want to do this for you. Never mind, I asked. Just let me take the boy up, please.
He would find the boy a home. Forget the questions. That was stupid. All Aggie wanted was to get away from this crazy place and this crazy old woman. She reached out again, but this time her fingertips caressed Aggie's cheek. It took everything he had not to recoil in disgust.
Now I let you go, she said. I give you life. In return, you give this baby a future.
He nodded again, couldn't stop himself from nodding.
Thank you, Hillary, Aggie said,
and he meant it.
I'll do it.
Follow me and be very silent. I will show you the way out.
Chapter 31. None More Black. Brian Clouser at his side, Pookie Chang stepped out of the elevator onto the third floor of the SFGH mental health wing. Pookie had sweet-talked their way into the building. The staff was on edge, but Brian's badge helped overcome initial objections. Pookie couldn't wait to get his own badge back from Zhao. They walked down the hallway of Ward 7A. Pookie took note of the reinforced doors with their electronic locks. SFGH was one of the few places with a psychiatric emergency room. The hospital took in patients with all manner of psychiatric issues, and at all times of the night. It was to be expected that some of those patients were violent and needed secure holding facilities. That made 7A the most locked-down, defensible spot in the hospital, which was probably why Zhao had put Erickson here. Pookie and Brian turned down a hall to their left. It wasn't hard to spot which door led to Erickson's room. The two men in full SWAT gear standing outside of it gave things away. They wore thick black jackets, made even bulkier by the body armor that covered them. The men had armored gloves and knee pads, heavy black boots, and black helmets with goggles waiting to be pulled down in front of their eyes. Black AR-15 assault rifles hung from their necks, barrels angled to the floor.
"They look serious," Brian said.
"You're just jealous because they wear more black than you do," Pookie said.
The men did look serious, though, and not at all happy about pulling what appeared to be guard duty.
"I know those guys."
"Shocker," Brian said.
"The one on the left is Jeremy Ellis. The other guy's Matt Hickman. Come on."
Pookie walked toward them. Brian followed. Helmeted heads swiveled toward them. Hickman's hands flexed on his AR-15. Ellis held up a black-gloved hand, palm out.
"Hold it, Chang."
Pookie stopped.
"Jeremy, my man, how's the softball team? Still doing the department proud with that 315 average?"
Jeremy looked surprised.
317? A hitting streak! Awesome!"
Jeremy smiled, but only a little before his oh-so-serious cop face returned.
"I'm guessing you want in there, but it's not going to happen."
Pookie thought of bringing up the fact that Hickman's son was the starting point guard for Mission High, but it didn't look like small talk was going to get him anywhere.
"Maybe you guys didn't get the memo," Pookie said. "Chief Zhao reinstated us. She told the duty sergeant."
Jeremy shook his head.
"News to me. Last word I have is you guys aren't cops. I'm not supposed to allow anyone in this room, especially you, Clouser."
Brian looked at the door. For a moment, Pookie wondered if Brian might rush it. Hickman must have wondered the same thing, as the barrel of his gun moved up a tiny amount. Jeremy pointed a black-gloved finger back down the hall.
"Guys, do us all a favor and hit the road, okay?"
Brian shook his head.
"We just want to make sure Erickson is safe." "He is," Jeremy said. "We have three guys on the roof and four more in a ready room they made for us downstairs. No one is getting in here. I'm not going to tell you again. Get out of here."
Pookie flashed his best smile.
"All right, gents, keep up the good work. Brian, let's go."
Pookie started heading back down the hall. Brian paused, his hands flexed into fists. Then he followed. Pookie stayed tense until the elevator doors shut, and he knew Brian wouldn't try to go back.
"Bri-Bri Zhao's got it covered."
Brian didn't look convinced.
"I don't know, man. What if one of those basement creatures attacks?"
"Those creatures get shredded. Zhao mapped it out for us, bro. This isn't chasing shadows in a darkened alley. The SWAT boys are serious business. They've got this."
Brian chewed at his lower lip. He nodded.
"I guess. I'm still going to hang out on the hospital grounds tonight. You good for that?"
Pookie shrugged.
"Sure, I'll hang out here. Got to be some hospital-centric plot lines for blue balls that I can work on. And it's not like I have to be up early for work tomorrow, as apparently we're still unemployed. I wonder why Chief Zhao didn't call the sergeant like she said she would."
When Amy Zhao said she would do something, you could bank on it. Whatever the reason for her dragging her feet, it was probably a good one. Chapter 32 Home Sweet Home. Chief Amy Zhao pulled into her garage. She came out of the car with her Sig Sauer up and at the ready, sweeping the barrel in a 360-degree arc around the garage. Nothing. No one had ever threatened her family before. No angry gangsters trying to get her to back off. No drug lord's promise of revenge. Not even some thug receiving a sentence of 20 to life looking at her and saying, "You're gonna pay." Nothing. Not until today. She couldn't quite draw in a full breath. Her chest seemed compressed, constricted. Over the course of her career, she'd been shot 3 times in the line of duty, shot at more times than that. And yet she had never felt this terrified. The garage's interior door led into the kitchen. She heard a movie playing in the living room. She moved as silently as she could, not really knowing why, hoping Rex and his creatures were dumb enough to be overconfident. Maybe she could sneak up on them and end this quick. She heard something else. Her daughter Tabs, crying softly.
"If they hurt you, baby... If they lay their hand on you, I'll kill them where they stand."
Amy Zhao moved into the kitchen. Finding it empty, she followed the sound of crying into the living room, the barrel of her pistol leading the way. Her husband was on his knees, a gag tightly wrapped around his head and mouth, his hands tied behind his back. On Jack's left stood a whimpering, gagged Tabs, her face streaked with tears, her arms wrapped in a death clutch around a teddy bear. On his right stood Myrrh, head tilted down, eyes glaring out from beneath her thick black hair. Myrrh was also gagged, but she didn't really look scared. Her expression reeked of anger and hatred. Standing behind Amy's family, monsters. Two of them. The first had short brown fur and a face like a dog. He was so big his head seemed to reach up to the ceiling. His bottom jaw skewed to the right, and his long pink tongue hung down off the left side. He wore flower print Bermuda shorts and nothing else, save for a heavy, dirty blanket draped around his shoulders. He held a stockless, drum-fed automatic shotgun, an Armsel Striker, in his left hand. He was so big he made the bulky weapon look like a pistol. The shotgun was pointed at the back of Tab's head. The other monster had a snake face and the girth of a bodybuilder, most of that bulk hidden beneath another ratty blanket. He wore jeans, work boots, and a blue San Jose Shark sweatshirt that strained at the seams. He had a gun, too, a .44 auto mag, the muzzle hovering less than an inch from Myrrh's temple. In between the two hulking nightmares, standing as calmly as you please behind her bound and gagged husband, was Rex Doprovdychuk. Amy knew, instantly, that this boy was completely in charge. She pointed her Sig Sauer directly at his face.
"They're going to drop those guns and get out of my house! Tell them to do it now, Rex, or you're going to die."
Rex smiled. It was a pleasant smile, tolerant, but not quite condescending. The kind a nice kid gives to adults he thinks are okay, but still way uncool.
"Then both your daughters will have their brains blown all over your living room carpet," he said. "Put down the gun, Mrs. Zhao."
Amy realized her hand was shaking. With a flick of her wrist and a pull of the trigger, she could kill the brown-furred one, then maybe get a snapshot at the snake man. But could she do that before either of them fired, murdering her beautiful girls? And would her aim be dead on if she couldn't even keep her hands still? In a hostage situation, you were never, ever supposed to give up your weapon. If she did that, she had no power. Rex sighed. He seemed bored.
"Mrs. Zhao, just put it down."
The dog-faced man pressed the shotgun barrel to the back of Tabs's head. She cried louder. Her little body shook with sobs.
"She's just a baby. Don't hurt my baby."
Amy lowered her weapon. Rex pointed to a spot in front of Jack.
"Right there, please."
"Don't do it. Don't give up your weapon. Don't do it."
Amy tossed the Sig Sauer. It hit the carpet with a light thud. The boy calmly walked around Tabs, picked up the pistol, then walked back behind her family to once again stand between the two monsters. Amy was naked, helpless.
"What do you want?"
Rex grinned and nodded slightly, an expression that said, "I really want to help you out."
"Tell me where Savior is," he said. "Then I want the names of everyone who knows about Marie's children. Finally, I want to arrange a meeting with those people."
She couldn't give the boy Savior's location. They'd attack him, kill him. And what would they do to the other people who knew about Marie's children? Rich Birdie, Sean Robertson, Jesse Sherrow, the mayor, Brian and Pookie, Dr. Metz, Robin Hudson. Amy couldn't put those people in danger.
"No one knows but me," she said.
She had to buy time, get word to Brian maybe, see if he could move Erickson to another location.
"And Savior checked out of the hospital this morning. I don't know where he went after that."
The boy's grin faded. He sighed and shook his head. A put-upon, exasperated teenage killer could decide if her family lived or died.
"Choose," he said. "Choose what?"
The boy spread his hands, the gesture taking in Amy Zhao's daughters and her husband.
Choose which one dies.
Amy's throat tightened. She tried to speak, but nothing came out. Why had she given up her weapon? Why?
Mrs. Zhao, we're wasting time. Choose. No. Please, don't kill anyone.
Rex shook his head.
It's too late for that. You can either choose one, or I can choose two.
Her vision blurred briefly before a hot tear streaked down her cheek, leaving a cool tingling in its wake. She saw no doubt in Rex's eyes.
No. No, please. Kill me instead. Let them go.
Rex held up a hand, palm toward her, fingers pointed to the ceiling.
I'm going to count down from five, he said. San Francisco, General.
The words rushed out of her mouth.
Savior is there. I know which room.
The boy nodded.
That's great, Mrs. Zhao. But you already made me tell you I was going to kill one. I can't go back on my word. Choose. But I told you. I know access codes to the building. Five. No, wait. I can get you those names.
He bent his thumb in. Four? Monsters with guns counting down her family, her daughters, the love of her life. He bent his pinky in, trapped it with his thumb.
Three.
This can't be happening. This can't be happening. Don't kill my babies. This can't be happening.
Look, she said. I swear I can give you what you want.
He bent his ring finger in, trapped that with his thumb as well.
Two.
Amy's gaze snapped back and forth across her family. Tabs, then Jack, then Murr, then Jack, then Tabs. He bent in his middle finger, leaving only his pointer extended.
One. Oh, Jesus Christ, how can this be happening? Not my daughters, not my daughters.
Zero.
Jack! I choose Jack!
Amy screamed. Jack's eyes went wide with terror. Or was that anger, betrayal? He started to scream, but she couldn't understand him through the gag. Rex reached up and patted the dog face's shoulder.
Pierre, do what the chief says. Chief Zhao, if you make a move, one of your daughters will join your husband, so you better stand real still.
The snake face reached down and picked up Murr with one arm, pinning her arms to her sides. She looked like a frail little doll. The monster pressed the .44's barrel under her chin, pushing her head back a bit. Now the girl was scared. Her wide eyes betrayed genuine fear. Pierre's right hand grabbed her husband by the top of his head, big brown fingers wrapping down across her Jack's cheeks. Effortlessly, the monster lifted him right up off the ground. Jack started to kick, but his feet were bound as well as his hands. His body thrashed as he fought to break free. The boy stepped back to avoid Jack's heels. Pierre never moved the shotgun from the back of Tabs's head. Tabs shook with sobs, but she made no move to run. Pierre lifted Jack higher. The monster tilted his dog head to the left, so the skewed jaws opened horizontally rather than vertically. The long white teeth glinted colored plasma reflections from the TV. Pierre slowly bit down on Jack's neck. There was the briefest second as the teeth penetrated the skin. Then came the blood. Thin, spraying jets splashed against Pierre's face, splashing on Tabs, falling on the carpet. Jack's body lurched madly. His knees whipped up, then drove down. His bound feet kicked back and forth. His shoulders twisted as arms fought against ropes that would not break. Amy heard herself screaming, heard words torn by panic and denial and anguish. Pierre let go of Jack's head, but the man didn't fall. His ravaged neck remained tightly pinched in the skewed jaws. Pierre shook his head like a dog with a chew toy. The gag blocked most of Jack's gurgling screams. Amy heard a cracking sound. Pierre paused and drew in a deep breath through his long nose. As he did, Jack looked at her, eyes pleading for help. The monster gave one final, hard shake. Jack's head sailed across the room. Trailing blood, it bounced once on the lazy boy, then came to rest on its side, eyes facing Amy. The pupils dilated, as if Jack saw her, recognized her. His lids closed once, then slowly opened. Dead, unmoving eyes stared out. The girl's screams brought Amy back. She found herself lying on the carpet. She'd passed out. For the briefest of moments, she allowed herself to imagine it had all been a dream. But then she saw Tabs, gagged and screaming, her father's blood matting her hair and dripping down her face. Amy saw the monster holding an automatic shotgun to Tabs' head, a monster soaked with that same blood. Amy saw Murr tucked under the Snake Man's huge arm. Murr kicked and fought, but Snake Man just ignored it. And in the middle of it all, Amy saw a smiling teenage boy.
"There," Rex said. "That's all done. Now, I'm going to ask you more questions. Unless you want me to make you choose again, you'll answer them."
Amy nodded and kept on nodding, over and over and over again. Chapter 33. Handiwork. Rich Verdi was just about maxed out. Too many years of this bullshit. Time to start thinking about retirement. Someplace warm. Someplace with rich divorcees and enough booze to drown out any memory of this fucking city. Boca Raton, maybe. The wind whipped at a blue tarp tied up inside a cluster of Golden Gate Park's gnarled Australian tea trees. The trees were spooky enough all by themselves, even without the corpses that had been found hidden among the twisted, contorted trunks. Rich and several uniforms stood just outside the tarp. He didn't want to be in there, not with those bodies. He'd had his fill of symbol killings, more than enough for one lifetime. Baldwin Metz was on the way. The Silver Eagle would get this body out of here lickety-split. That was the process. That was how things were done. Rich just didn't want to be part of that process anymore. He wondered how he was going to tell Amy. How would she take it? Well, that wasn't his problem. She could go cry on the shoulder of that needle-dick husband of hers. Rich had put in his time. 30 years worth of time, fuck you very much. He didn't know Amy a goddamn thing. This latest killing, though, it was a problem. The media had got to the bodies first. Pictures of two corpses with missing hands would be all over the front page of the Chronicle. Hell, it was probably already up on the paper's website. Whoever this killer was, he had struck twice in as many days. Yesterday morning, the first set of bodies had turned up at Ocean Beach. And now, less than 24 hours later, a second set. All four victims showed the same M.O. Broken necks, missing hands, and gnawed feet. Gnawed feet, for fuck's sake. And, of course, someone had given the bodies a golden shower. Nah, not Boca Raton. Maybe Tahiti. The symbol had been found at both sites. He'd been at this game long enough to know it was a new killer, not the same one who had whacked Paul Maloney and those Boyko kids. He could just tell. The only break was that this time the symbol had been carved into the back of one of the tea trees, and the media had missed it. All this, and Amy had yet to call him back. So unlike her. Robertson was on the way, though. Sean could run things. Hopefully he'd get here before the rest of the media did. A uniform walked down the dirt path, then ducked under a line of yellow police tape and approached.
"Inspector Verdi, more media is showing up," he said. "We've got CBS4 setting up now. Cron TV's van just pulled up into the park, and the ABC7 chopper is closing in."
"Just keep them all back," Rich said. "The last fucking thing we need is for them to start asking questions about a serial killer, you know?"
"Might be too late for that, sir. I think they already have a name for him. They asked me if I knew anything about the handyman."
The handyman? Yeah, Tahiti. That would do the trick. Chapter 34. Aggie Gets Out. Aggie James wasn't sure how long he'd been following Hillary. She had led him out of the bassinet room and back into the dark arena maze. Many twists and turns later, she'd started up a narrow set of rough steps cut into the wall. Carrying the baby, Aggie had moved so carefully, keeping his left shoulder against the wall as he made sure his right foot didn't slip off the uneven edges. Those steps rose 40 feet to the spectator ledge. She had led him into a narrow tunnel at the back of the ledge, just a few feet away from the last step. Aggie had turned for a last look down below before going in. The ship was off to his right, back end buried in the cavern wall, front end pointing across the oblong cavern. There had been activity on the ship's deck. Hillary's people preparing for some kind of an event, maybe? They'd been following the tunnel for 15 minutes, maybe 30, he wasn't sure. This time, at least, she had a battery-powered Coleman lantern to light the way. She seemed to know the location of every rock, every turn, every jagged outcropping of rusted metal or moldy wood. He knew this because those things caught him, poked him, snagged him while she avoided them all with a subtle turn, a simple twist. He cradled the knit bag in his right arm. Inside, the baby boy slept. Aggie felt the child's faint warmth through the fabric. The boy weighed almost nothing. Aggie could carry him forever if he had to. Finally, Hillary stopped and turned.
"Move carefully here," she said. "Step only where I step."
She set the lantern down and stepped aside so Aggie could see a small stone forest. 15 or so piles of stacked rocks rose from floor to ceiling. No, not piles. Columns. The columns supported big slabs of concrete, chunks of old brick wall, and blackened squares of timber. This strange ceiling ran the final 15 feet of tunnel, right up to where it dead-ended at a giant, dirty sheet of plywood. It didn't take a genius to see the plan. Make any column fall, and the whole kit and caboodle would collapse, filling the tunnel with tons of dirt and rock. Hillary gestured to the ceiling.
"You understand?"
Aggie nodded. She slid around the first column. Aggie watched her. She looked like an old lady, but didn't move like one. Her agility and balance complemented the ridiculous strength Aggie already knew she possessed. With each step, she wiggled her shoe in the dirt, leaving a clear footprint to show the safe path. She slid around the second column, then waved him on. Holding the baby-filled bag to his chest, Aggie followed in Hillary's footsteps. He took his time. She didn't seem to mind. As he passed the third column, he felt something, some kind of trembling beneath his feet. An earthquake? The rumbling increased. With it came an echoing, grinding roar. How could there be an earthquake now, when he'd almost made it out? Aggie held the baby close, looked up, and waited for death. The rumbling subsided. The roar faded away. Hillary was laughing silently, again waving him on. 2 minutes later, they'd passed all the columns save for one. The final column was less than 2 feet from the piece of plywood. Hillary grabbed the plywood by a pair of metal handles screwed into it, then slowly slid it aside, revealing a hole perhaps 3 feet wide. The hole led into a deep blackness. Aggie felt the tender kiss of something he hadn't known for days. A breeze. Fresh air. Well, not fresh. It smelled of metal and grease. But it was far fresher than the still air he'd breathed since he woke up in the white dungeon. He again felt the rumbling. Something big. Something mechanical. Something getting closer. Hillary held up a hand, palm out. The gesture said, "Stay there. Don't move." Aggie waited. She turned off the Coleman, leaving a blackness that made the walls close in. The sound grew louder. The tunnel rumbled. Suddenly there was a flash of light, the roar of metal wheels on metal tracks. A muni train. He was in the San Francisco subway. Aggie tried to calm his breathing. He couldn't allow himself to believe this was it, that he was finally getting out. The Muni train passed, its roar a fading echo. Hillary turned the lantern back on. The columns hadn't collapsed.
"Now you go," she said. "Do you remember what I told you?"
Aggie nodded. She was giving him life. He would honor his promise to her. No way was he going to wind up as a groom. No way. He turned to hand her the baby so he could duck out of the hole, then paused. A sudden, all-powerful twang of anxiety ripped through him. What if Hillary took the baby and ran? She waited.
"I'm going to set the baby down," he said. "Can you step back?"
She smiled, nodded, then backed away. Aggie gently rested the bag on the ground, then stepped through the small hole and out of the death trap tunnel. He stood on a narrow ledge that ran perpendicular to the tracks. He bent, reached back, and was again holding the boy. Aggie clutched the bag tightly. The anxiety faded away. Far down the tunnel to his right, he saw the light of a station. Hillary worked the plywood shut behind him. Aggie's eyes slowly adjusted to the darkness. The hole he had crawled from was gone. All he could see were the hexagonal tiles of the subway's walls. The plywood was a tile-covered plug that perfectly fit the hole, sliding home as sure as a puzzle piece. If he hadn't just come through there, he would never have known it existed. But that didn't matter anymore. He had survived. Aggie kept his right hand on the tile wall as he walked. He didn't know which rail was the third rail, the one that might electrocute him and the boy. It was probably the one in the middle, but he wasn't taking any chances. He drew closer to the opening into the station. The tracks led out of the tunnel's darkness and alongside the station platform. He saw a few people up on the platform. The trains were still running, so it wasn't early in the morning. Aggie carefully stepped off the ledge and over the tracks, moving to the platform side of the tunnel. He slid along with his back to the wall. He felt a hint of a rumble. Another train was coming. He had to move fast. The people on the platform would see him, but he didn't have a choice. He was still draped in the stinking blanket. That's how he would get past those people, by just looking, acting, and smelling like the homeless bums who wandered down to the Muni stations all the time. He reached the end of the tunnel. The platform came up to his chest. He lifted the knit purse containing the boy and gently set it on the platform's warning stripe of yellow. Aggie crawled up. People turned to look, saw what he was, then immediately turned away. Aggie picked up the bag. He held the baby with one arm, and with the other, pulled the blanket around them both. His heart hammered in his chest. So close. So close. Aggie saw the brown sign in the white ceiling, the white letters that spelled out Civic Center. He looked at the digital sign that told of the next train, and saw that it was 11:15 p.m. He forced himself to walk, not run, toward the escalator that led to the surface. Homeless people didn't run. All he had to do was keep up the illusion, and everyone would ignore him. Illusion. How odd to think of it that way. Wasn't he a homeless person after all? No. Not anymore. Aggie had done his time in the gutter. He'd lost years mourning, feeling sorry for himself, feeling sorry for his losses. He'd given up and tuned out. That time was over. He was alive. His wife and daughter were gone. Nothing could bring them back. He should have died down in the tunnels, in the white room, but he had a second chance and he wasn't going to screw it up. He had a responsibility now, a responsibility to protect the child he held in his arms. He had sworn to find this child a home.
Why don't I just raise the kid?
He realized that hidden thought had been lurking at the edge of his mind ever since he looked in the bag and saw the tiny baby.
You were a parent once. A good parent. That robbery wasn't your fault. There was nothing you could do.
A second chance. a second chance to get things right. Aggie felt full of hope, full of a sudden and overpowering love for life. He moved toward the escalator that would lead him to the surface. And then the baby cried. Not a soft cry, not a muffled, I just woke up cry, but rather a full-blown, I am not at all happy cry. Loud, piercing. The dozen or so people on the platform who had gone out of their way to not look at him now turned to stare. The baby screamed again. The kid was probably hungry. This was just a baby being a baby, but Aggie knew what it looked like. A shabby, smelly bum with a screaming child hidden somewhere beneath a filthy blanket. Aggie saw hands reach into pockets and purses, then come out holding cell phones. He turned back to the escalator. A woman stepped toward him.
Stop!
Aggie took off, his newish boots thumping out a staccato drumbeat on the escalator's metal steps. He heard and felt similar pounding behind him, the heavy steps of men. The first escalator took him up to the station's main floor. One more escalator, and he'd be out on the streets. There were more people up here, heading home from bars or from late nights at work.
Get out of my way!
Aggie ran, carrying the baby bag in both arms. His legs felt weak. He was already exhausted.
Stop him!
The men behind him screamed. Most of the people in front of him quickly got out of the way, but one man, a kid of no more than 20, stepped in front of him. Aggie slowed, then tried to cut left. His foot landed on his blanket. The blanket slid across the polished floor, and his foot flew out from under him. In the split second it took him to reach the ground, his only thought was to protect the baby. The back of Aggie's head cracked against the marble, and everything went black. Chapter 35. Date Night. The faint but beautiful sounds of a plinky piano echoed from inside of Mommy's cabin. There were no lights in there, just darkness and music. People lined the arena's ledges, holding torches that flickered like big stars against the cavern's blackness. Alone, Rex stood on the ship's ruined deck. He held a wicker basket with a present for Mommy. Tonight, he would become a man. Everything was happening so fast. He and Pierre and Sly had brought the chief of police and her daughters back home. The chief had given up a bunch of names. They'd even printed pictures of those criminals on Chief Zhao's computer, so the soldiers would know if they had the right people. The chief's husband was cooking in the stew. Most of him, anyway. His head was in the basket. Mommy liked brains. As soon as Rex finished this ceremony with Mommy, he and Sly were going to plan how to use Chief Zhao to round up the criminals. Firstborn had allowed the bullies to live, but Rex would not. Once those who knew of Marie's children were gone, Rex's people would become even more of a secret. Hillary wanted the people to spread, and so did Rex. She said the only way for that to happen was to make new queens. The only way to make a new queen, she said, was for a king to mate with an old queen. Rex was the king, and that was that. If he was the king, though, didn't he need a crown? Maybe someone could make one for him. The people had built all these amazing tunnels. Surely they could make a kick-ass crown. He felt so nervous. He'd never had sex before. Would he get it right? Two white-robed men walked out of Mommy's cabin. They stood on either side of the door, waiting. The one on the left wore a devil mask. The one on the right wore a mask that looked like Osama bin Laden. They both waved Rex forward. Up on the ledge, all the people waited for him to enter. Rex turned slowly, looking up at the ledge, at the torchlight-illuminated faces of his people. Everyone was here. Now was the time to make Firstborn understand that all of this belonged to Rex, and Rex alone.
"I have made a decision!"
he shouted. His voice echoed off the arena's walls.
"I am not going to hide in the caverns and let other people go fight. I'll fight with them.
I'll lead like a real king. But that means Savior might get me, or the cops might, or someone else. I've decided who will rule if anything should happen to me. I name Sly as my successor.
Rex heard applause. Not as much as he would have thought, though. Didn't everyone like Sly?
Sly is also a fighter,
Rex shouted.
If he and I both get killed, then Hillary will be our ruler.
He hadn't seen Hillary around, but she was probably somewhere up on that ledge. Rex knew it was a good decision. Firstborn hated Sly, so maybe he'd try to kill both Sly and Rex. But Firstborn had saved Hillary once. Would he kill her as well? Was his need for power that great? The announcement was done. That meant no more stalling. Rex had to go into that cabin and be with Mommy. A smell tickled Rex's nose. He sniffed lightly, then deeper. What was that? He turned toward Mommy's cabin. He sniffed some more. His face suddenly felt hot. Another step, and he stumbled a little on a loose board. He managed to catch his balance before he fell. Wouldn't that be embarrassing, to fall in front of everyone? Rex stopped. He looked down. He had the boner of all boners. Wow, did his face feel hot! And then a deep voice came from inside the cabin. Mommy's voice.
Venez à moi, mon roi.
He didn't understand her words. He didn't care what she said. Didn't care about anything any more but that smell in his nose and what waited for him there in the darkness. Rex walked through the cabin door.
Chapter 36. Brian and Pookie meet Aggie James. They weren't officially back on the force yet, but a lead was a lead. Brian wasn't going to let a little thing like being fired get in the way of pursuing it. They'd heard the call come in. A bum had been picked up at Civic Center, a bum carrying a baby. The bum had been injured. Paramedics had brought the bum and baby both to SFGH. When the arresting officer called it in, he described the baby's blanket as being covered with circles and slashes, occult kind of stuff. A bum with a baby, just like Mike Clouser had described. Most of the cops at SFGH were preoccupied with Erickson's security. That, combined with the flurry of activity that had blown up surrounding this new handyman killer, and with Zhao not being around to direct traffic, meant Brian and Pookie weren't really on anyone's radar at the moment. They stepped off the elevator onto the second floor of the hospital's main building, far away from the mental health wing. The injured bum was on this floor. Brian looked down the hall. It wasn't hard to spot the right room, because a uniformed officer sat on a chair outside of it.
Shit, Brian said. Think you can talk your way past this one, Pooks, or is the force no longer strong with this one?
A dismissive huff escaped Pookie's lips.
Nigga, please! Don't you recognize him? It's Stuart Hood!
Brian did recognize Hood. He was the guy who'd first interviewed Tiffany Hine after Jay Perlar's death.
Come on, Pookie said. I'll talk my way in there. Let's see if Daddy really has lost his touch, or if the SWAT boys were just a fluke.
They started walking. Brian hadn't made it 10 steps before he slowed, then stopped. A new smell. A strong yet faint scent, cut with the normal hospital odors of medicine and disinfectant. He knew that smell. It was a lot like the odor from Rex Dipravdichuk's house. Similar, yet subtly unique. The baby, or the bum, or both, were Zed's.
Brian, Pookie said. You okay? You're stumbling a little.
Brian blinked, shook his head.
Yeah, fine.
He'd have to learn to control this stuff. What if he ran into one of those basement critters and they had some stink that made him lose focus? Losing focus against something like that bear creature could get him killed. Pookie put his hand on Brian's shoulder.
You sure?
Brian took a long breath, gave his head and shoulders a quick shake.
Yeah, I'm good.
He followed Pookie to the room.
Stuart Hood,
Pookie said.
Good to see you again.
Hood looked up and gave Pookie a wide smile.
Inspector Chang.
Hey, call me Pookie. Hey, did you hear that Zhao reinstated us?
Hood looked from Pookie to Brian, then back again.
No, I hadn't heard that. That's great news, congrats.
Gracias,
Pookie said.
And we're back on a case that's related to what Tiffany Hines saw. You remember her?
The werewolf lady.
Pookie snapped his fingers.
That's the one.
He tilted his head toward the door.
We got an ID on the bum who had the baby?
Hood nodded. Prince came back already. The guy's name is Aggie James. A few minor drug possession charges, but he doesn't have any priors of note. No permanent address. Witnesses said he came out of the subway tunnels. I heard the docs say he has a concussion, but it doesn't sound like anything major.
What about the baby?
Brian said.
Is it his?
Hood shrugged.
No idea. No idea on the baby yet. Kid's in the maternity ward.
Pookie pulled out his notepad, sketched out the same triangle and circle symbol Brian had first drawn, then held it up so Hood could see.
Was this the symbol on the blanket?
Stuart looked, then nodded.
Yeah, the blanket's in there with him. Ambulance brought him right here, so his personal effects haven't been processed yet. I was told this might be a kidnapping, so someone has to watch him.
We need in that room, Pookie said. Just a few minutes, you mind?
Stuart shook his head, then stood and opened the door to let Brian and Pookie enter. Inside, a black man lay in a hospital bed. Blankets covered him up to his chest. He had a white bandage wrapped around his head. Handcuffs kept his left hand locked to the bed's frame. Brian waited for the fluttery sensation in his chest, but it didn't come. The man in the bed was just that, a man. There was a cart against the wall. Pookie walked to it and picked up a clear evidence bag holding a blanket.
Symbols all over it,
he said.
Take a look at this.
He tossed it to Brian. Brian caught it. Even wrapped in the plastic, the smell was nearly overwhelming. The scent seemed to fill up his brain. Just like at Rex's house, the odor made him want to do something. Except now that urge was 100 times more powerful. Maybe 1,000 times. Brian handed the blanket back to Pookie. The smell wasn't just coming from the blanket. Brian checked out the cart. On it were bags containing the bum's clothes and one holding some kind of knit purse. They all had that powerful odor. Brian walked to the hospital bed and leaned in. The bum had the scent on him as well, but not as strong. The man seemed to sense their presence. His eyelids fluttered open, and he slowly turned his head to look at them.
You, cops?
Pookie sighed.
I gotta remember to turn off that neon sign above my head. Hello, Mr. James. I'm Inspector Chang. This is Inspector Clouser.
Brian nodded once.
How you feeling, Mr. James?
The man blinked slowly, as if it hurt to move even his eyelids.
I'm alive, he said. Where's my baby?
Here in the hospital,
Pookie said.
He's fine. You claim he's your baby?
Aggie stared first at Pookie, then at Brian.
He is, Aggie said. Bring me my boy or I'll sue your asses.
Pookie shook his head.
Child Protective Services has to verify the child's identity.
Aggie tried to sit up. He seemed surprised to find he could barely move his left hand. He looked at the handcuff holding him in place, then lurched so suddenly the bed rattled.
No! Don't you chain me! Don't you chain me!
Chain me? A strange way to describe a handcuff. Aggie's wide eyes stayed fixed on his restrained wrist.
Let me go,
he said in a thin whisper.
Bring me the boy and let me go.
We can't,
Brian said.
Mr. James, tell me why you drew those pictures on the blanket.
I didn't draw them. Let me go. Don't chain me. Please let me go before Hillary finds out I failed.
Brian looked at Pookie, who shrugged.
Hillary,
Brian said.
Is Hillary the baby's mother?
Aggie shook his head violently. His breathing grew more and more rapid.
Mommy is a monster!
Brian felt a cool sensation in his chest and stomach. The baby, the bum, monsters. They were all connected, all a part of Brian's past.
A monster, Brian said. That why you drew those pictures on the blanket? To save the baby from the monster?
I said I didn't draw the pictures! Let me go. Don't let them take me back into the tunnels. Let me go, goddammit!
Pookie leaned in.
Tunnels? Where? Tell us more.
Aggie shook his head.
Don't remember. Don't take me back to the white room. Let me go. Let me go!
The room door opened. Stuart Hood leaned in.
Guys, just letting you know I'm out of here. Dispatch said Zhao is pulling all security from the hospital. I'm supposed to clear out right away.
Clear out? Pookie said. Who's your relief? Hood shrugged.
Someone's coming soon, I guess. I don't know, man. I was told to get out of here pronto. The SWAT team is pulling out as well. Later.
Hood shut the door, leaving Brian and Pookie alone with Aggie James.
Pook, something is wrong.
Really? Was your first clue Zhao wants to leave a child napper unguarded? Or was it that she put a friggin' SWAT team on Erickson, and now she thinks he's fine and dandy on his own?
Pookie's cell phone rang. He looked at it, then held up the phone so Brian could see the caller ID. Chief Amy Zhao. Brian nodded. Pookie answered.
Good evening, Chief. What's up?
Pookie listened, nodded.
I see.
He listened some more.
Sounds nasty. No, actually, I don't know where Brian is, but I'll find him and bring him. Yes, Chief, okay.
Pookie put the phone away.
Zhao said there's a third handyman killing. Two bodies in the Fort Mason tunnel.
I know that place,
Brian said. It was an abandoned train tunnel cut under Fort Mason. It had been closed off and boarded up for years, but people still got in there all the time. No lights, no traffic. The perfect place to drag in a victim and do what you pleased. A new serial killer. A crime scene location that made sense. Yet it didn't feel right.
Did she say if we were reinstated to active duty?
Pookie shook his head.
She didn't mention it.
Two people in the SFGH complex were involved with Marie's children. Jebediah Erickson and Aggie James. Zhao had suddenly ordered that they be left unguarded. And it was dark outside. Dark, and getting darker.
Pooks, I think Zhao's been compromised. That or she was setting this up all along.
You think Marie's children are coming?
Brian nodded.
Yeah, and fast. Got a handcuff key? We have to get Aggie out of here.
Pookie nodded, produced a key from his pocket. Brian unlocked Aggie's handcuff from the bed frame. Aggie's eyes seemed to light up. Then fill with betrayal when Brian clicked the open link on his own wrist.
Get up, Mr. James, Brian said. Come with me if you want to live.
Pookie helped the man out of the bed.
Where are you taking him?
I'll lock him in Jessup's car for now, Brian said. I have to get something out of there. Can you get up to Erickson's room?
Pookie nodded.
Just hurry the hell back. I just made an executive decision. You can handle all the monster shit.
Brian put a hand around Aggie's waist and guided the confused, weak man out into the hall. Chapter 37. Calling in the Troops.
It's about time, Chief, Rich Verdi said into the phone. Media is sticking their nose all up in this one. Where have you been?
I don't know.
Her voice sounded strange, maybe a bit hoarse.
Chief, you okay? What do you mean you don't know?
Hold on a second.
He heard her sniff, clear her throat. Maybe she had the same bug that had knocked Clouser on his ass a few days ago. Rich Verdi remained just outside of the tarp. The Silver Eagle was in there, doing his thing with the bodies. Rich stared up at the pitch-black night sky.
The tall pines surrounding the handyman crime scene were actually a touch lighter than the dark sky above them, making him feel as if he were deep in the forest. Sometimes it was hard to remember Golden Gate Park was a swath of greenery in the middle